East Carolina Manuscript Collection, Oral History Interview, August the 18th, 1972, with Miss Lorena Kelly, Methodist missionary to the Congo.
Is it close enough?
Yes, I told you that would be done, but I turned the volume down a little, so.
Oh, all right. Well, I was thinking this morning it should be up. And I know you can get it too close. I think this is about right then. All right.
Would you like to begin, Miss Kelly, by telling about your arrival in Africa, when you went over, and the situation?
Yes, I can even begin when I left the United States, which was in September 1935. And at that time, the Congo was ruled by Belgium. And we could serve better if we had studied French. Of course, I'd studied French in this country, but that's different from learning to speak it. So I went by way of Belgium and spent 3.5 months studying French there, and left in January of 1936 to continue my journey to Congo. And on February the 26th, 1936, I arrived at Wembanyama. Now, Wembanyama is it is our oldest station, it is our largest station, and it was where our work was founded, and I was there for about 3.5 months studying the Otatela language. Maybe you'd like to know what a station is like. All of our work at that time was in the rural area of Africa. And I was working in what we call the Central Congo Conference. And that conference is located right in the heart of Africa, about equidistant from the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean, and about 3 degrees south of the equator. In fact, I have seen the sunshine playing down in the fireplace as it came down the chimney, which indicates to you how closely overhead the sun really was. On a station, the general pattern is that we have schools, of course the church, that comes first, that's the primary purpose of our being there, and it is in the center, and whatever else we do, of course, is an arm of the church. It is a part of the church itself, so we always have the church. There's always a primary school, and at Wembanyama we had a primary school, and we had a teacher training school, had a Bible school, and a hospital with a school for training assistant nurses. And the evangelistic program and the educational program, which was in the Wembanyama district, was located in Wembanyama at the Wembanyama station. Now, the one at Loja, I was on at Loja for about 20 years before I left. And it, in general, is the same, except we don't have a hospital. We do have a dispensary. But in addition, we have also a printing press at Loja, where we print our Sunday school lessons and other materials for our schools and churches throughout the conference. And we have boarding departments, because we have boys and girls who cannot stay at home, and we think it's better for them to stay on the station so that they will be free to study, and a program is worked out so that they have ample time for study for all types of the work, and they are in under this constant supervision of the leaders of the school and of the boarding department. So on all of our stations we do have a boarding department, both for boys and girls, and where there's a Bible school we have an organization which takes care of the Bible school students and their families. Some of them are single, they live in the dormitory, some of them are married, and we have little cottages in which they and their wives live. And that is true at Loja, where our Bible school is now located.
How many professional staff members did you have at your station?
At Loja, we had about 18 in our high school when I left. I mentioned the primary school at Wembanyama, but of course a number of years had passed and our school had developed into the high school stage, so we had about 18 members on the staff of the high school the two high schools, the junior high school and senior high school, and perhaps two or three on the Bible school, but many of the members of the staff of the high school taught also in the Bible school. In the print shop, we had probably six or eight working there. And in the rural schools, we probably had 25 or 30, maybe more.
Are these white professionals? Are
all of the rural school workers manned by the African people?
By the natives.
Yes, and even the supervisor, the inspector, the state inspector, was an African. In the beginning, it was by missionaries, but now, in general, all of the administrative work of the church, of the schools, and all of the work that we're doing out there is under the supervision of the African leadership. Our bishop is African, all of our district superintendents are African, all of our ministers are African, all the directors of high schools, with one exception, are African people. So we have very few missionaries in comparison with many years ago, but we have many, many more African leaders in comparison with many years ago, and that is the direction in which we want to go.
Are any of these your former students?
Oh yes, quite a few of them are. I had an interesting experience in Kinshasa a short time before I came home. I was there on Sunday and went to church on Sunday, and I sat down in church by a young man. He came in later, very fine looking young man, immaculately dressed and with a very gallant manner, and I shared the songbook with him throughout the service, and I was very impressed with him. After the service, we introduced ourselves, and he introduced himself to me as one of my former students. Well, I was embarrassed because I couldn't remember him. I suppose I've taught thousands of Congolese and can't always recognize them, especially when they're about 1,000 miles away from the classroom. And he could see that I was, and in order to convince me that he was one of my students, he simply took his Bible he had in his hand and opened it up and showed me my own handwriting on the flyleaf. And since the time I had given him that Bible until that moment, he had gone to France, had graduated from the university in law, and was at that time engaged in the Ministry of the Interior of the Congo government. So that gives you an idea of what happened to some of our students. In fact, the first prime minister was one of our students.
Well, by and large, most of your officials and your professional people in not only the Congo but elsewhere in Africa received much of their training originally in the missionary schools.
Yes, that's very true. And one of our missionaries, and who is now working in this country, is at the head of the Advanced Special Department of the Southeastern Jurisdiction Conference, Billy Starnes, said that every head of state south of the Sahara Desert was a product of the church. So that means that missionaries have gone into the continent many years ago and have opened up schools and have trained the people, and today these students have become leaders of their nation, in the government and in schools and in business and every phase of their lives. In our own country of Zaire, formerly the Congo, for many years, up until a very short time before independence, the only schools throughout the whole nation were schools which were owned and maintained by the church, either the Protestant or the Catholic Church. And today, if you were to ask any leader, from the president right on down, about his church affiliation, almost without exception, each one would respond by saying, "I am a Protestant," or "I am a Catholic, a member of the church." And I do add that some have deviated from what they have been taught, but they are still members of the church. They love the church. They respect the Christian religion. They want their children to be trained in Christian teachings. In fact, this new Congo government, which is made up exclusively of Congolese Zaire, require that we teach religion every day in the week in the primary school and twice a week in the high school. So I think that is very indicative of their appreciation for the Christian training they've had and the degree to which they want their children to have Christian education.
You earlier indicated that you were in Belgium for a while studying French before going to the Congo, and that French was the official language in the Congo. What of the native dialects?
In the Congo, there are about 200 dialects, and one of those dialects is Otatela, the language which I learned and which I used in all of my work when I first got out there, and continued to use it until I left with village people and with primary school children. It was the language which is used in all church services and every contact except in the high school. And the French, therefore, was the vehicular language, and all of the teaching that I did in high school I did in French, except one place I had in English, and I conducted that in English, of course. So in a country where there are 200 languages, it was impossible to think of developing high school and universities in 200 languages. And since the Belgian people had introduced French language, and since they had been all over the nation, it was scattered throughout the nation, and people were speaking it everywhere. So therefore, it was accepted as the national language, and is still, even though it's a foreign language, it's still the official language of Congo.
What of the transitions that took place in Africa during your long stay there? I'm sure you saw.
Yes, I saw a great deal of that. When our missionaries first got there in 1914, there was no written language, not even a written language, and they had to hear the language and figure out from what they heard a written form. Just to let you see what they heard at that time, I'll say John 3:16 for you in the Otatela language. Neriam zambi akalangi wala kete otamanya bakanda washonande toila kandote neri otichela witawu tabukaki kele la lumula funju. Well, that's what they listened to. And as they listened to it, and with whatever help they got, they had in it, they had to pick out the words and work out the grammar and write it down.
But there was no written form.
No written form whatsoever. And they had no schools, of course. Our kind, now they had their schools, they had their form of education, they were intelligent people, and they were living according to what wisdom they had. But as they became a part of a world, and with international relationships, it became necessary to get acquainted also with the world and with the Word of God. So the missionaries opened schools and had to write their textbooks and had to print their textbooks. And so there is a great transformation from a verbal language to a written language. That's one of the main ones, because springing from that has come all these others. If they had not been educated to the degree to which they weren't highly educated. We had only 12 college graduates at the independence time, but they had much general education and much experience. And from this beginning came all of these other developments. And so another one I would say is that they have now, in our Otatela language, that's the Bible right over there, they have the Bible in their own language, both the New Testament and the Old Testament. They were finishing the New Testament just when I got there in 1936. And 2 or 3 years ago, they finished the Old Testament. It's recently been published. So there's one transformation. They have the Word of God where they can read it in their own language and interpret it from their own hearts and minds as God speaks to them. Whereas in the very beginning days, they had to listen to a missionary read it. It wasn't even written down, you see. And so that's one thing that makes it possible for them to be the leaders of their church today, the very fact that that language has been written down in the Bible is in their own Otatela language. Another one is the leadership of the church has been transferred almost entirely now from the hands of the missionaries into the hands of the African people. As I have indicated, we have only one missionary who is a director. let's see, two I know of, two right now who are directors of high school, all the rest of them. So all the leadership of that educational work practically is in the hands of the African people. All of the evangelistic work is in the hands of the African people. And even our bishop, who is the very top leader of this church of 100,000 members in Zaire, is an African. And the women themselves are taking leadership. They're members of their local organizations, they're members of their officers in the conference-wide organization. The African women are conducting women's schools on stations and out villages and around. So that even among the women who were, at the time we went there, were considered very inferior, incapable of even learning anything from a book. Now they stand up before a class and teach boys and girls, and in high school, girls often carry off the honors. So that's another transformation from the educational work and the evangelistic work, the Bible, and the uplift of women. That probably is one of the greatest, because the women have self-respect, the men have respect for them, and the men even do what they can to push the women forward and the girls forward. This junior high school for girls, which I organized and directed in the last 2 years I was there, was a conference-wide school. And this had to be voted by the conference, and at that time, nearly all of the conference members were made up of men. So that is a dramatic illustration of how the attitude of man toward woman has changed. In the beginning, they kept them down. They weren't intelligent enough to learn anything from books, and here they were voting in a school exclusively for girls.
Are women yet involved in politics in any way?
In some instances, yes. The Minister of Family Life and Social Affairs in Zaire, when I left, was a woman. There are a number of mayors in the nation. The big city, metropolitan city of Kinshasa, is divided up into what they call communes. And I suppose we'd call them zones, I don't know. But a city of 2 million people, they have to have some kind of a sectional division, I suppose. And many of those women were mayors. In 1968, I went up to Kisangani to attend a meeting of the Congo Protestant Council, and we were welcomed by the mayor, a woman. So in the government work, the women are taking leadership. And the 24th Assembly of the United Nations had as its president Mrs. Angie Brooks from Liberia, Africa. So you see, they're coming even into the international organizations. So that's a tremendous a reformation, I suppose you'd call it. Transformation.
Were the cities, when you first arrived, great metropolitan centers as they are today?
Not nearly as large. Not nearly as large,
yes. Years?
In 1960, when we gained our independence, our largest city, Leopoldville then, now Kinshasa, had a population of about 350,000, and now they say population is about 2 million. So you see in this decade, a little over a decade, how the population has grown. It has grown in other cities as well. People have found out that in the cities is where the action takes place, and where the bright lights are, and where they can have, hopefully, a better life by earning a better salary and being able to have electricity and some of the other conveniences of life, and they naturally flock to it, just like people in this country do.
Well, is Africa becoming industrialized? Or
to a certain extent. 90% of Africa is still rural. But then when you see these big cities like Kinshasa and Johannesburg, with a million population of a million people, and beautiful Nairobi, I don't know exactly what that population is, but it's one of the prettiest cities in Africa. But there is some industry. Of course, the mines are the big things. In Zambia and in Congo, some of the richest copper mines in the world are there. Some of the 96% of the diamonds of the world come from Africa. 65% of the gold comes from Africa. So you see, the mining is one of the main things
well,
in that
the
country.
Well, the rural population, what do they do for a living? Is it farming or?
Yes, farming, and it's very primitive farming. In our area, they had no horses, no oxen, no trucks, absolutely nothing but a hoe. And the women would take that hoe and dig into the earth and plant their grain. And then when the grain was harvested, they'd go back to rice in our country. And they'd go back and break the heads off, or with a little knife, and break those heads off and put it in a basket that they carried maybe on their backs or on their heads and carry it to the village. So it's very, very primitive. Now, in some areas where Western influences come in and where their Europeans have introduced modern farming, they do have machinery. But in the rural area in which I live, there's absolutely nothing in the way of, not even a wheelbarrow to carry their produce from the fields to the home.
Well, now you were in Africa at the time of the turmoil of the early 60s.
Yes. Yes. It was in 1960. And June the 30th, that they gained their independence, we had a great celebration. Missionaries and African together had a big feast and a happy time together. And that was typical of what happened throughout the whole nation. And we were also pleased that such a tremendous celebration could take place with such calmness and with such dignity. And we were rejoicing over that. But about 8 days later, the whole situation changed. It was about time for our annual conference, and we were preparing to go over to Katakokombe, another station on which this annual conference was to be held. And it was about 1 o'clock on Saturday, before I was to leave on Monday, that I was listening to the radio, and I got a station from Elizabethville, it was then called, now Lubumbashi. And I heard in English from a station that I'd never had before, and this voice boomed out saying, this is the British consul ambassador, will all the British subjects go to a certain place to evacuate, and then the voice of America, or the vice versa, I don't remember in the order in which they came, and giving advice to the American citizens. Well, that was about 1,200, 1,500 miles away. While we had missionaries down there, it wasn't an immediate concern right where I was. I was very concerned for them, but it didn't affect what we were doing there at that moment. But before 24 hours had passed, we were affected, and we were beginning to have to make decisions too. We had heard how the trouble had started in various parts of Congo, and how it was coming closer and closer to us. By that time, I suppose, we'd heard that it was within 300 miles of where we were. So it was coming very fast, and we were discussing among ourselves on the station of Lodja. We were also discussing it with people on other stations by way of radio transmitter. What shall we do? Shall we go or shall we not go? Well, no decision was made, but we did go on to Katakokombe to the conference. I remember somebody said over the radio, be sure to bring your sheepskins and some winter clothing, because if we have to evacuate, you'll need those things. So I took those with me, and on Monday I went to Katakokombe. All the other missionaries came, and all of the delegates, the African delegates, we were all there together on the Katakokombe station to have our annual conference. And of course we were very interested in what was developing throughout the nation, because it concerned us so vitally at that moment. And we were listening to the radio. It was pouring down rain on the outside. The clouds were black, but these political clouds were even darker. But we didn't get any encouraging reports at all. So that night we met in the church with the leaders of the conference, the African leaders and the delegates, and discussed at length the question about whether we should leave or not. And after much consultation, it was decided that we should leave. So one of the radio operators, one of our missionaries, got in touch again with the Salisbury, American embassy people, or consul, and made plans for the planes to come up to get us. So that night, some of the missionaries and the leaders, African leaders of the church, met, and we turned over to them practically all of the funds that the Board of Missions had sent out to us for work in the conference, and also the responsibility of the leadership of the conference. Well, they were ready for it. They had mixed emotions, of course, but it wasn't a sudden thing for them, because all during these years they've been given responsibility all along, and they've been participating in the executive committee and the conferences, and they knew the organization, they knew the programs and all. So while it was a goal toward which we had worked, we had not worked expected to reach it so dramatically and so suddenly, but it happened that way. But we knew that God was with them and that the church work would continue. So, and the next morning, while we were waiting for the United States Army and Navy planes to come up to pick us up, to take us out, one of the missionaries said to me, "You know, in these short hours, our church has grown 20 years. And I think that's true, because we've seen how they accepted the leadership of the church and have continued with it." So we got into these planes and went on. There were two motor planes on just a dirt landing field out there in the plains of Catacombe. And they took us down to Camina, which was a base still maintained and owned by the Belgians. And there they kept us and finally brought in a Globemaster. And when everybody who was supposed to go on the Globemaster arrived, we left. It was about 9 o'clock at night. This Globemaster was a tremendous thing. I'd never seen one before, and I haven't seen one since. But it just opens up like the mouth of an alligator. You can drive trucks in there, automobiles, anything you want. So we went in and drove it. I guess it's kind of like going into the Noah's Ark. We didn't take any trucks with us, but we did fill it up with people. And I remember when we started off, I was accustomed to riding only in a two-motor plane. And it just seemed we'd never get off of the ground into the air. Kept going and going and going. But finally, we were airborne and went down to Salisbury. There, we were met by people who knew we were coming, the Rhodesian people. And they had committees appointed, and they met us at the airport in buses and took us right into a soup kitchen and served us sandwiches and soups. It was cold down there, wintertime down there. We'd come from tropical Africa. And then, I don't know why they took us to two, but they took us to another one and served us another meal. I guess the first one was supposed to be the midnight supper, and then the next one breakfast, maybe. And they even had clothes that they had gathered up from people, and they said, "Now just go right in there and pick up anything you need. Just go look through all through there, any kind of clothing you need, you get." Because they too knew we were coming from tropical Africa and that we would not be accustomed to that cold weather and wouldn't have perhaps wouldn't have any warm clothing. And the next morning, our own mission people came and picked us up, and some, we went to some of their stations. Some of the missionaries whose furlough was already due came home, and some of us did other things. One of my colleagues and I wrote books, and another one supervised the illustration of them as we wrote them. And so different ones did different things. And I got back to Oroja in 1965 after having left in January. But I went back in 1961. Could stay only a month, and everybody had to leave again. And I didn't get back until 1965. And I stayed until 1969.
Were there any actual hostilities in the area, Central Congo, where you were?
There were some. There were some. There was hostility between sections of our own tribe. In the Loja area, in the beginning of the development of our work, the leaders, African leaders, came from Wembonyama because they were trained down there, and there was a great revival meeting, and that revival meeting stimulated a mission type of work, and these leaders then went up into the north section, which was in the Loja section. So they were considered the foreigners to the local people. They called them the people of the land, and Asambala was the word they used. And then when the country got its independence, there was jealousy for fear some of the outsiders would get the top leadership, you know. And they had a war between them. I've forgotten how many people were killed, maybe 80 or 200, I've forgotten exactly, but quite a few. And most of them had to leave their homes and go out into the forest and stay out there for a long time. They had a hard, hard time, lost everything they had, had a hard time coming back. So there was strife there. And then we found some bitterness when we came back in December of 1960, hoping to stay, and that's when we were able to stay only about a month. We came back to Lodja on the 23rd of December, and we went to Usambara, having come from Zambia. And there were a number of people for Lodja, and they had to put on an extra plane. Well, there were a dozen of us, I suppose, and so instead of putting us on a plane that stopped along the way as it came down, it was about a two or three hour flight, they put us on the special plane. And when we got to Lodja, the plane stopped and we got out and went on to the mission. The people were there to meet us. In the meantime, the second plane, which had stopped along the way, came in. And this upset the people. It was a time when everything was very, very tense. The United Nations was in there, and there were so many people. The communist rebels had come in, and the local people, uninformed, didn't know who were their friends and who were not their friends. And anything that came in unusual frightened them very, very much. And so when the second plane came in, they were indeed disturbed. The authority to come in was supposed to have been given through Lulberg, which is 300 miles away, and the message did not get to Lodja. And they didn't know that the second plane was to come. And so they sent for the security forces in town, and they came out there and were very upset. We had hardly gotten to the mission and had even gotten our baggage out, and they said, this car of soldiers drove up and they said, you all get right back in the car and get your baggage and take everybody back out there who came on the plane. And let's see, I'm getting the chronological order. Anyway, but they lined us up in the airport. I believe that was before we went home, and called the roll. And I guess he was chief of police, called the roll. And we got to me. He smiled and he said, you are my former teacher. So that was a very welcome smile. And then they said, now you can go back to the mission, go to the mission. And right down about 100 yards where we had to turn to go to the mission was a man with a submachine gun in his hand just pointing right toward us. I said, would you please tell that man that we have permission to go? So we got home all right. But then when we did get there, they came for us again. And we went back out there and had to wait to be inspected. They wanted to inspect all of our baggage. What had caused all this trouble was one of the soldiers who was on guard out there recognized among the passengers one of his former mates in the army. He was not out, and he knew that person was not out, but he was not in uniform, and he knew something was wrong. So he was the one that alerted the security forces. And so they arrested him, and I think a woman that was with him, maybe, and they did find guns and, I believe, ammunition in his suitcase. And that really made them afraid. So they arrested the pilot, took him into the town, put him under house arrest. And I was told later by the member of our church who was the chief of police or assistant police, I think it was chief of police, said that twice they started to take him out to the military camp to kill him, and each time he wouldn't let them do it, take him back. Well, they finally got to us and investigated our baggage and then let us go back. Then when we got back to the mission, they came and got our radio transmitter. This transmitter was what we used to talk with other missionaries on other stations, you know, and it was what we used to help us to get out that time by using talking down to Rhodesia. And we considered it one of the means of security. But they came and took it from us, so that was gone.
Felt isolated without it.
That's right, isolated without it. So on the same plane, some of the new missionaries came, and they went on down to Wimbonyama that same day, I believe. And And by that time, the board was so concerned that they had provided a plane, and that same day, the plane arrived at Wimbledon. But they took the plane, grounded the plane, wouldn't let them use that. So that was a form of security, was taken out of our hands. Then we had expected the next day to go over to Catacombe again for Christmas. That was Christmas Eve. So we finally got ready and started over there. We got about halfway, and we were going through the forest, and some of the men of the forest came out with their jungle knives, machete we call them, in their hands and tried to stop us. Well, they didn't stop us, but we went a little farther, and some of the officials did stop us and wouldn't let us go on, made us turn around and go back to a village that was close by to have our baggage inspected. And when they came, they took our car keys. So every form of security was taken away from us. The plane was grounded, the transmitter was gone, and now they're taking our car keys. So the one main security was God, and of course he was the security that we had. Well, they talked for a while, and one man said, what do you mean? You missionaries come out here and to bring us the Word of God, the Bible, and here you come out here and bring guns to shoot us. They had gotten a message that these missionaries had come on that plane to kill everybody because of that gun they found, you see, in this man's suitcase. And that day was the day the school children were going home. And they went all over that country as they went home telling everybody that the missionaries had come back to shoot them all, to kill them all. So that was a very tense time. And we did have to go back. We didn't get to go to Catacombe. We had to go back and had to spend Christmas at Loja. Well, finally, one of our ministers went out to the biggest village there and explained to them that what the situation was. And little by little, the tenseness eased up a bit. And about a week later, we started back to Catacombe. We got back to that same place these people came out with their jungle knives again. But this time, this security officer, one of our church members, with some soldiers, led us. He got in a jeep and went in front of us. And then I believe I was next. We had two cars. I was driving one, and Mr. Reed was driving one, Mr. and Ms. Reed. And then behind us was Mr. Shungu, who was now our bishop. He wasn't then, but he was a minister then. And his car was filled with soldiers. So we got to that same place, and the security people got by. But when we came, then they stopped us, tried to stop us, and we didn't stop. But when Mr. Shungu's car came then, these soldiers jumped out and tried to grab these men, and they ran into the forest. Well, we went on to tell the security people what had happened back there, and they went back, of course, to see about it. Well, they tried their best to get them out of the forest, and finally they said, "But if you don't come out of the forest, we're going to take your mothers to jail." Well, that's something they can't usually stand. They can't stand for you to mistreat their mothers. So all of them came out, I think, but one or two, and they, of course, arrested them and put them in jail, or maybe took them on to Catacombe, I don't remember, which anyway, they arrested them, had them in custody. But then we continued our journey, and when we got, I must have been the two districts of the provinces, we got to the border, this security man went back. I guess he thought he was out of his territory, and he thought we were safe, or he wouldn't have let us loose there, I'm sure. So he went back, and we went on, and Mr. Reed, who'd worked in that area years and years, thought, well, from now on, I'll find friendly people, but he didn't. All along the way, anybody that we met had that antagonistic attitude toward us. So we went on to Catacombe to spend the night, and the next day I was going on to Wimbunyama, one of the other daughters of one of our missionaries and I. And we were going with Mr. Shungu in his car. We were to meet him up at the administrator's office, and we got to the office, and there was the administrator at his desk, and here were these soldiers over here with their guns, and here were these missionaries wanting to go on to Wimbunyama. And the soldiers saying, no, we want you to take us back to Loja. They'd been ordered to wait there for somebody to take them back, somebody else, not us. But no, they wanted to go back. I felt sorry for that administrator's a young man, younger than you, I suppose, and of course all this new to all of them. And it was easy to tell where the power was. It was in that gun. He dared not disobey, do anything contrary to their wishes. But again, the Lord came to our rescue. A truck drove up on the outside, a commercial truck, and somebody went out and asked them if they could take the soldiers, and they said yes. So that solved the situation, and we went on to Wembonyama. On the way down, we stopped at one of our biggest churches, and we found that even down there, this message had got out that everybody, the missionaries had come back to kill everybody. And the pastor told us that some of the people had even withdrawn from the church. Well, of course, we had an opportunity to explain to them what it was about. So little by little, the tension was released a little bit. But we went on to Wembonyama, and I was down there just about a month and went back to Loja. And a week's time later, we were on our way out again. It just got worse all the time. So we left January the 23rd, just exactly a month from the day we came in. So I was in Zambia for a year, about a year, working on these textbooks. And then I was in Kinshasa for a couple of years doing another type of mission work. My furlough was due in 1963, and I came home. And in the meantime, I had been told that I was appointed to this junior high school for girls to organize it and direct it. And one missionary said, if you want anything when you get out here, bring it, because it's not here. So I'd gotten a lot of school supplies and my own things. I had about 35 different cases, trunks and so on, and I shipped them. And I had nothing but my suitcase, was ready to go about 48 hours from then. And the word came then, Sunday afternoon. I was leaving on Tuesday morning, I believe. And Sunday afternoon, some friends came by and said, have you seen the Charlotte Observer? I said, no. And they had, and they told me about the death of Burley Law, one of our pilots. And so, of course, I knew that was at Wembonyama, and that was something very, very, very serious. So Monday morning, I had a telephone call from the board saying that I couldn't go back. So I stayed a month longer, and finally they sent me to Mwanguishi, and I taught high school there for a year. 1965, I got back to Loja. So,
think of any other points to cover?
Okay. Well, I was down at Mwanguishi. They had one of the biggest conferences they've had, and we had representatives from the United States there. And just a week after they had gone, the communist rebels came in from the Standerville area, and five of our couples were still there, and then they took over. And eventually, they were let the women and children leave. But they kept the men there for 2 months. What was it, 5 months? 2 months, I guess. And they just told them everything they must do, and where they must go, and had a guard with them all the time, in the classroom and everywhere else. And from time to time, they'd get them out and tell them they were going to kill them. One time they had a man, one of our missionaries, up against the wall, ready to be shot. And every time, though, they would release them. They didn't know why. Of course, they had their ideas. They thought maybe they were trying to pressure them and to give them the more money, because from time to time they'd come and ask for money. And of course, the hospital was there. Among them was a doctor and his wife, or where his wife had gone. There were two doctors, Dr. Hewlett and Dr. Sixty, were both there. And I guess the other three were educational workers. So they were interested, of course, in having the doctors there and having medical care for their soldiers. For other people. But then it was when Burley Law came down there. That was before the women lived, I believe. Yes, women were still there. where he came down from Loja in the mission plane. And he knew they were there and thought maybe they needed some help. But the missionaries didn't want him to land, but he said he could not go away and leave them down there in that situation. So he landed, and a short time after he landed, they shot him. And he died in a few hours and was buried. But they finally got out. They had a rough time doing it, but I think they have recovered. But that must have been an awful experience.
Oh, sure it was. I know you were glad you were away.
Yeah, I would like to have that kind of an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think so. We do have medical work, which is very well developed, I think. We have three hospital buildings. And before independence, we had three hospitals actually in operation. Two of the hospitals, as such, have been closed, but they maintain a dispensary in each of the buildings. At Wembanyama, we have a hospital, I think, of about 200 beds, and we do maintain the hospital and a school for training boys and girls to be assistant nurses. We have a maternity ward where many, many children are born every year and are cared for by the medical people who are there. In 1969, our last missionary retired, Dr. Hewlett, and just at that time, very dramatically I think, one of our students who had just graduated from medical school in France came back to take up his medical